two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to The Bubble. This is your host, Andy Slavitt. We have an exciting show for you, one you've been waiting for your entire life, which is, if that is, you knew what Omicron was, and if your entire life you wanted to hear a silly game show about how to stay safe during Omicron. It's actually our safe or not safe episode around Omicron, what makes the world safe and what doesn't. It is tons of your questions that I run by two great people, Caitlin Jadalina, who I just think is marvelous. She goes by your local epidemiologist. She's at the University of Texas. She's an assistant professor. She's great. And Bob Wachter, who many of you know and love for good reason. He is at UCSF. He's the chair of the Department of Medicine. And let me just say that Caitlin gives him a run for his money. You know, the way this thing works, you'll hear, but I think you're going to have to decide pretty quickly whether you are Team Caitlin or Team Bob. Team Caitlin or Team Bob. Just, you're going to be making your decision. Feel free to light up Twitter with your choice throughout this. But really, I think it's just been our creative way of bringing you the information that you need to stay safe during Omicron. Let me expand the dialogue before we get going to talk a little bit about overall response, policy response to where we're going next, because there's been a lot of noise about back to normal, this thing's over, let's take off the masks. There's been a lot of people saying, well, gee, that's a little concerning. Don't things turn around quickly? There's been some noises from the WHO in Europe about letting go of guidelines, even in San Francisco, as things drop. So let me tell you how I look at that and I think about that. First of all, individually, there really are very few wrong answers. You know, if you feel comfortable dining indoors, if you feel not comfortable dining indoors, if you're really worried about getting COVID, if you're not so worried about getting COVID, there's things in your life that you've been missing that you wanted to take more advantage of. You know, understanding, particularly if you're vaccinated, that you can do those things, you're not going to put your life in danger, that there are those things that are worth doing. And if you feel a little more reluctant, that's okay too. And try as hard not to criticize people for having different points of view. The only rub in that, the only difference in that is I just think it's, and I think most of you listening probably agree with this, it's just irresponsible to put other people at risk. So if you find the average person who says, I don't mind getting COVID, that's their business. But if they do things that are reckless to put so that other people might get sick, well, that's where we should step in with some form of modest and reasonable protections. That's why requiring vaccinations in certain venues and requiring masks in other venues during key times is important. But we should be judicious And I think the more that this becomes less life-threatening, and I'm not saying that we're there, and that it certainly is still life-threatening to people who are unvaccinated and to other people that are frail, but the more that it becomes into that category, if it does move into that category, and the more people have choices, i.e., can I get vaccinated? Can I protect myself? You know, the less you probably will need to end up worrying about these restrictions. Coming out of pandemic is challenging when we're at that point, because you don't really know you're out of it until you're long out of it. And so, you know, taking down steps is as hard as putting steps up. And so my view is, if we do start to see cases drop significantly, as we will, two things that I have to say about that. The first is that when cases go up, we are always more doom and gloom than we probably should be. And when cases are dropping, we're always more optimistic than we probably should be. So the talk tends to bounce a little more to the extreme reaction, because this is just a roller coaster, and that's what you do in these roller coasters. But also would say that as things come down, we absolutely should be comfortable taking down some of these barriers societally. Again, doesn't mean our individual choices can't reflect our own individual needs, but that's certainly the case. I also just would continue to point out that everything good we have is worth working for. So we value in-person learning in school, which we all do. Then in the right moments when you need them, masks are a way to do that. They're a small price to pay. No one loves them. No one wants to wear them forever. But in order to be able to do things that don't put other people at risk, like teachers or other students and their families, that's why that's appropriate. Now, there's a lot of people who would say, but that impedes on my rights and the rights of my child. And, you know, why should I carry the obligation of society based upon my kid, my decision? You know what? There's room for disagreement. There's room for hopefully respectful disagreement on some of these things. But that's how I think about it. And I think, you know, it is psychologically sometimes difficult to get used to reduced restrictions, but, you know, we all want to be there, and we will be there eventually. This thing, can't say when, can't say what, will bounce up and down. I did put a tweet thread out about how we will know a little bit. You can look for it. It's about Florida. I think what we see in our historic Florida bump in the summer in cases, that'll be a good tell for us as to whether or not the kind of immunity offered is the kind that will really protect us and protect us more going into the fall, and what it will protect us from. Okay, I need your help with one other thing. We have a very weird problem. We have $40,000 we have to give away to COVID relief causes. For those of you who don't know, In the Bubble gives away my share of the money that comes in from the show, because you listen to it, to people who are doing great things to help people in COVID relief. And at the end of the year, a lot of people listened. Thank you very much. And now we've got to give out $40,000 to organizations that are doing something to help people in need of COVID relief. We have a great list of organizations we've given money to. You can see that list if you look at the show notes. But please, via tweet off of this episode, go in and just enter your favorite organization, one that you think we should be donating this $40,000 to. Thank you for your help, and thank you for listening. So now we're going to get to our show, and it is going to be fun. I want to see who does a better job answering your questions, Team Caitlin or Team Bob. Well, it's so good to have you both. I think safe to say, a massive upgrade from prior safe or not safe episodes.
That goes without saying.
Yeah, it goes without saying. I think people have had enough of Farzad Mastashari, and it's a great pleasure to bring actually two of the people that are most beloved by In the Bubble listeners, Bob Wachter, who tried to impersonate me for a few months, from UCSF, who I think is known to everybody who's been following the pandemic at all. Welcome, Bob. You're contestant number one.
Thank you, Andy. It's great to be here. I remember when you came back in May and I asked you what was going to become of this podcast as COVID went away. So we see how good I am at prognostication, but let's try it again.
What is it Yogi Berra said? Predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Exactly.
And now I'm going to introduce the winner of today's show. I guess I shouldn't give that away in advance. Is your local epidemiologist and maybe your favorite epidemiologist too, Caitlin Jettolina.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be back.
So for those who haven't listened to Safe or Unsafe before, it is our game show where we ask your questions that you have sent us directly to our two contestants. They give their answers, and then I come up with some on-the-fly scoring system to tell you why Caitlin won. Who will have won. So let's dig in. And some of these are going to come directly from me. Some are from voicemail. Okay, first question. First question for both of you comes from Dana Dean. She asks, previously we were advised that a vaccinated person being with a group of people who are also vaccinated was pretty safe. What are the risks of transmission between fully vaccinated and boosted people with Omicron? So let's start with you, Dr. Wachter. And by the way, that's the last time I'm going to call you doctor on the show, just for simplicity.
Please, thank you. That's fine. So early in the vaccine era of the pandemic, there were proclamations that vaccinated people could not spread the virus. And those were very heady days. It's no longer true. So we've seen by the number of breakthrough cases, by the fact that we all know people who've been vaccinated and got infected, that vaccinated people are fully capable of getting infected, that the amount of virus they carry and their ability to infect is somewhat lower, probably by virtue of two things. One is they are somewhat less likely to become infected, although clearly not zero, and they transmit a little bit less. But I don't think the ground rules we used a year ago, where a vaccinated person is perfectly safe to be with, we can't use anymore, particularly at a time like this where Omicron is so incredibly, it's really raining Omicron almost everywhere, getting a little bit better, but still there's a lot of Omicron around. So the bottom line is, if the only way you're deciding that someone is safe is that they're fully vaccinated, that's no longer good enough. They're capable of having the virus and infecting others.
Someone asked this to Caitlin, and I'm going to put a little extra spin on it, given how much more capable you are than Bob, which is, does the implication that this spreads among vaccinated people also mean that whether you're vaccinated or not is more and more your business than other people's business?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
In other words, why should we care if other people are vaccinated if their vaccination status doesn't have that big an impact on us compared to our own vaccination status?
I love the fact that you throw the political part into her. Thank you, Andy. I appreciate that.
No, you're not off the hook.
I think it's a really good question. You know, I actually still have hope that our boosters do reduce transmission to some point, whether it's reducing infection altogether, or even if you get a breakthrough infection, you clear the virus much quicker than unvaccinated. And so I do hold out that, you know, vaccines will reduce transmission to some point, but it certainly isn't going to be what we saw in the beginning. I think the other really important thing is that, yeah, you know, a vaccinated person is safe. They have a very nice bubble around them. But on a population level, that's not necessarily the case. And so it really depends how we look on it, on an individual level or as a community level.
Well, let me ask you at an individual level, Caitlin, if you're vaccinated, if you're around other vaccinated people indoors, people you are positive or vaccinated, do you still feel the need to wear a mask?
I don't. I don't wear a mask with vaccinated people that I trust who are boosted.
And what about you, Bob?
It all depends on the context. Let's take San Francisco, for example. Last week, about 1 in 10 asymptomatic people were testing positive. So these are people who feel perfectly fine. When we parsed that at UCSF and looked at vaccinated versus unvaccinated, it wasn't that different. Maybe about 1 in 15 vaccinated people were testing positive. So they feel perfectly well. They're nice people. They don't want to infect anybody, but they are still carrying the virus. So I am less confident in an environment where there's a ton of COVID around, I'm less confident that if the only measure I have of safety is that the fact they've gotten three shots, I'm just less confident that that's a perfectly safe environment. I still do it without masks with very small bubbles of family members, basically. But if it's any larger a bubble than that, if we're getting together with five or six or eight people indoors, that is where I think the role of testing comes in. This will all change if the prevalence of the virus goes down tremendously, as it's likely to do in the next few weeks.
Got it. Well, so I love it. We have slightly different answers from both of you, which reflects, I think, slightly different risk profiles. I don't think it reflects a difference in understanding of the facts. I think it's important that people who are listening understand that their own assessment it requires some of that judgment. Let me ask the next question, and I'll start with you, Caitlin, because you've written about this recently. It's from Wendy Behuniak. She asks, how concerning is the new mutant, the stealth Omicron, that has been raising its menacing head in various countries? I think she's actually hinting at her own answer by saying menacing.
Yeah, menacing. You know, I'm not that concerned about it. We have preliminary evidence that shows that, yeah, this is a sub variant. It's a sister lineage we need to pay attention to, particularly because it looks like it's more transmissible than BA.1. But we do have preliminary evidence from Denmark that the severity doesn't look to be any different than the original Omicron variant. And we think that the vaccines will still largely work. And so to me, that's really good news. To me, it tells me that we're probably may have our waves kind of strung out a little longer than we expected. But in the end, this is still Omicron. We're still going to be falling in our descent. I'm much more concerned about another variant popping out of nowhere like Omicron did after
Got
Delta.
It. So your concern level sounds relatively low. Bob, what about you?
Yeah.
Lowish. I mean, it's going to be very confusing to people because they're going to hear from all of us, it looks like Omicron in the way it's acting in terms of severity and an immune escape. And yet, if it's winning the race against Omicron version one, then it must be somewhat more transmissible. So I'd say that's a little bit worrisome. It also, you know, for those of us that have been saying it's sort of hard to believe that something could come out and be even better than Omicron was at its job of infecting people, that the answer is, okay, there is something already that may be a little bit better than Omicron at infecting people. So I'm more worried, as Caitlin says, about what it means about the future and will there be other variants that do their jobs better than Omicron than specifically about this one. It's probably just going to be a slightly better version of Omicron, but as long as the vaccines work and the immune escape isn't very large and the severity remains lower, no indication that any of those things are not true, then not very worried about it.
Okay. So the next question is from Robin Achinge. I hope I pronounced it right, Robin. She asks, is there any evidence of Omicron behaving differently outdoors? Can we assume that small, unmasked outdoor gatherings are still safe? Bob, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I don't think there's good evidence of a lot of outdoor transmission, epidemiologic evidence. But I guess I approach this as this virus is better at infecting people than what it replaced. So the general rule that outdoors is completely safe, I have tempered my thinking about that a little bit. There's really nothing about outdoors that makes it completely safe other than a larger volume of air and the fact that it's usually a little bit windy. So if I am in a space outdoors where there's a lot of room around me and I'm walking the dog, I don't wear a mask, for example, when I'm walking the dog. But if I was at an outdoor cocktail party face to face with people, I would now have a little tiny concern about getting infected with Omicron in a way I would not have had with prior viruses, just because it's better at infecting people, either because it's better at latching onto cells or it's better at evading your immunity. We're still not exactly sure what the overall mechanism for being better at infecting people. But I think it makes outdoor situations a little less safe than they were before. So safe outdoor situations, I'm not worried about, but ones with in very close quarters, I now am a little more careful than I used to be.
Caitlin?
Yeah, you know, I very much agree with Bob. I think these questions are really difficult too, because it depends when we are in this wave and when we're not. You know, once we make it down Omicron and transmission is really low, outdoors are going to be super safe. And I don't think we need masks. But right now, we're at the top of the Omicron wave. Yeah, if you're shoulder to shoulder with someone outside, you need to be wearing a mask, period. If you're walking your dog, I don't think that's necessary.
Can I tell you, I went on a hike on Saturday. I'm going to tell a tale on someone who listens to the show, a friend of mine. Let's say his name is Steven. It actually is Steven. Sorry, Steven, for calling you out. I'm more making fun of you. But he had allergies, or so he claims. And so we were going on a hike with Steven and his wife and Lana and I, and he kept sneezing, and we were walking next to each other, and he kept close to me. And I was like, I kept slowing down or speeding up or doing everything I could to kind of not. And because, like, I'm much more conscious of somebody sneezing on or near me, even if it's an allergy, than I ever was in the past. And it's just, it had this weird sensation of almost like the feeling you get when you see someone run a red light. You're like, oh, something is, your brain tells you something's wrong here. Well, someone's sneezing near me, and if we're outdoors, like, that has me going, okay, I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah, we should bring Stephen on to see how he felt about the hike with you, because it probably wasn't all that much fun having you run off the trail all the time. I think that, you know, there's a part of our brain that has just been PTSD'd over the last couple of years, and that little fight or flight reflex is now very finely tuned to see a threat and be scared of it, which is why getting back to normal is really hard for people, because you're still processing all of the trauma over the last couple of years. That is not completely irrational, Andy. And the reason is not that Stephen's sneeze was necessarily a symptom of COVID, but as Caitlin said, when the prevalence is so high in our community, there may be, at the peak of the Omicron surge, there was probably about a 1 in 10 chance in many cities that someone who feels perfectly fine has COVID. And if that person is sneezing, whether it's from their allergies or from their COVID, that increases the level of transmission in the same way that, you know, you could be near someone. If everybody's sitting silently, the risk is substantially lower than if everybody's singing or shouting. And so it's not completely irrational for you to have taken that head dive into the rose bush every time Steven sneezed. It would have been interesting to see.
If you knew Steven, you'd have done the same thing.
Yeah.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where Cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ruthie Smith asks, and I'll put this one to you, Caitlin, first. Should we be holding back on travel while Omicron is spreading, or is it still safe? It's still as safe to travel as before. What precautions should we be taking if we do travel? Caitlin, what are your thoughts on travel during Omicron?
Yeah, you know, it's another good question. It's not as safe as before, because if you're going to the airport, there's lots of transmission. You'll be walking through SARS-CoV-2 clouds, basically. Now, that's the risk that someone wants to take is really up to their risk tolerance. You know, I'm a moderate risk taker, I will say, and I traveled at the peak on an airplane of Omicron because...
Did you feel differently than with the peak of Delta? Did it feel more scary, less scary, or about the same?
I don't know if it was more scary to me, but I was definitely like, this risk is high. I felt like the risk was higher.
Risk is higher.
Yeah.
Risk is higher.
Risk was higher. And, you know, I'm actually not very concerned about on the plane travel, like in the air. I'm a lot more concerned going to and from an airplane. And because, you know, a lot of people are taking off their masks, they're talking, they're eating, blah, blah, blah. And you don't have the best filtration in a terminal or in an Uber than you do compared to on the plane. So, yeah, I mean, there's moderate risk to it. You have to balance that risk with the quality of life that travel brings you. If you are dreading to go see grandma, then just cancel the flight and blame it on Omicron, right? But if you really need that travel to go see grandma that's dying, on the other hand, you know, it's a different risk that some people are willing to take.
I wouldn't fly to see Stephen if my life depended on it. okay, Bob, just answer maybe just this way. The one element of the question, do you feel it's riskier, relatively speaking, to travel during the peak of Omicron versus Delta?
Riskier to if you look at the chance of getting infected, and then less risky if you do get infected that something terrible will happen to you. And I think those two things sort of cancel each other out in a way.
I guess, but it depends, you know, what matters more, what you're more concerned about.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and if you're healthy and boosted, you know, it's different than if you're unhealthy,
Yeah, I think it's someone who's gotten three shots. I think the other twist on with Omicron is once we saw the curve in South Africa, Andy, and, you know, saw it go up and come down super fast, it felt like, okay, this is a two-month period of badness. And therefore, travel that is truly elective, I'm going to put that off.
Got it.
Why risk it? Because as we talk about the risk during the surge and not during the surge, people get very confused and they think somehow the virus is going to change or your immunity is going to change. None of those things will change. The thing that changes is the chances the person sitting next to me in the airplane is infected. And so in some ways, my feeling has been, why do it for things that are elective when you can delay it, if you can? If you have to travel, I think if you're wearing an N95 or the equivalent, you've put yourself in a situation where you're very safe. And on an airplane, recognize there's that period where it turns into a flying restaurant where it's really going to be important to have your mask on. If you do that, I don't see travel as being unduly risky. But again, why do it? Why put yourself at elevated risk while the prevalence is so high if it's going to go down in a month?
Got it. Okay, here's a question from Carla Q. Lee. And what she's basically asking is indoor dining safe? But she has a twist she puts at the end. She adds, my husband is tested regularly for work and would lose income and projects with a positive test. So, quote unquote, not dying is not the only goal. Really interesting twist. And I think reflects a lot of people's personal situations now where being out is costly. So given that, is there a threshold that we can look at? And I assume she means of prevalence or something, for us to let loose a bit. In other words, she may not live in the warm climes of California like you, Bob, or Texas like you, Caitlin, and she wants to go out and have a dinner once in a while, but she's got this concern that even if her husband gets infected, that's a really bad thing for them. I love this puzzle. What do you think, Caitlin?
I wouldn't risk it right now with the high wave. It's very possible to get Omicron inside while you're eating at a restaurant, especially if those tables are close, especially if ventilation's not good. Order out, order Uber, Uber Eats, or go sit on the patio. I think there's other options. And this goes back to what Bob was saying, is that is it truly needed? Because you could get infected and that could then impact your livelihood.
Is there a threshold under which you change your answer? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, there is a threshold. So when I say transmission is low, that is, less than 10 cases per 100,000 in a location or low TPR, test positivity rate. I will say, though, going forward, we're really going to need to recalibrate our surveillance system because that testing rates and those case numbers are not going to be as accurate anymore.
Given at-home tests, et cetera. Bob, what do you think? Do you agree with Caitlin, or is she dead wrong?
Well, let me start with where you're dead wrong, Andy. I live in the Bay Area, so it's not as warm as you folks who are luxuriating in Southern California. It's freezing here. But freezing, I mean, it's 50. It's not terrible. I ate out last night on the outdoor patio with heaters of a restaurant that we really like. And I will not eat indoors until the cases come down to a level similar to the one that Caitlin stated. Again, you know, do I need to do it this month? The answer is no. I'm happy to put it off until the cases are lower. The issue of how reliable the case rates are is a real one. So 10 cases per 100,000 people per day has a very different meaning in the world of a lot of home testing, where you might be missing 2 out of 3 cases, but still the curves are going to be reliable. You know, we will, when you see cases down to a tenth of what they were at the peak, if that's 10 cases per 100,000 per day, and you know in your heart of hearts, actually, it's really 15 because we're missing some, or even 20, it's still a low enough level that the chances that the waiter or my dinner companion has COVID has gone down by orders of magnitude and makes indoor dining much safer. It's just not safe now if you don't want to get COVID, and I still do not want to get COVID if I can avoid it.
The dilemma here, of course, is it may be where you live, Carla, that it's safer to eat indoors when it's warmer outside, and when it's easier to eat outdoors. That's unfortunate. Hopefully, you won't have to wait that long. Hopefully, in the spring, a combination of the weather and lower prevalence, somewhere around 10 cases per 100,000, will allow you to eat indoors. Cynthia Johnson asked a question that's on so many people's minds. I hear it so much, and maybe I'll start with you, Caitlin. And she wants to know whether or not there's data now to support whether or not people who are vaccinated and boosted are getting long COVID to the same degree as people who are not. Cynthia has heard that there's one study from Israel showing a very low risk of long COVID among people who are vaccinated and boosted. Is that true? And do we have any additional data yet from South Africa?
That is true. Vaccines reduce the chances of long COVID, and that's because, one, you can't get long COVID if you're never infected in the first place, and then, two, if you get a breakthrough case, we think, this is what the hypothesized pathway is that you have less infectious virals. You have a less infectious load, viral load, which helps not infiltrate your organs so you don't get long COVID. I haven't seen, and maybe Bob has, the latest data on boosters and the difference between being boosted and not boosted in long COVID. But I would assume that the more antibodies you have, the more protection you have, the even less likely is long COVID as a more of a dose-response relationship. But I would love to hear what Bob has to say.
Yeah, that's my... there have been a few studies in the last couple of days on this issue, and I believe they certainly have exactly confirmed what Caitlin says about the value of vaccination in decreasing the risk of long COVID. And I believe I saw one that said that looked at boosters versus two shots and saw additional value. I'd have to go back and take a look at that. I go into this feeling that vaccination, for both of the reasons Caitlin said, less likely to get infected and also less likely to get long COVID if you do get infected, lowers the probability of long COVID a lot, not to zero. So the number I float around in my brain, which is really a gamish of a lot of different studies, is 5%. That there's maybe for a fully vaccinated person, there's probably a 1 in 20-ish chance that you'll still feel crummy in one way or another a month or two from now. And in making all of your risk-benefit decisions, I think you have to say it's not a zero chance, it's not super high, but there's some small chance that you could still get a case that lingers. And it is one of the reasons why, when we had all this discussion a couple of weeks ago, is it inevitable you're going to get Omicron? First of all, I don't think it is. The best data says that maybe 40% of people will get Omicron, at least during this wave. And it's possible to avoid it. And if you can, you're better off, in part because of this small but not zero chance of getting long COVID.
Okay.
Andy, I'm just going to add, I think the other really fascinating thing that we're seeing in the data is that vaccines are helping if you had long COVID and then you get a vaccine. It looks like about 30 to 40% of people symptoms are alleviated, which I think is fascinating. Maybe that the vaccine is kind of reamping the body. Now, that's not everyone. And so that tells us that long COVID is being caused by multiple different pathways. But I still think that's kind of a cool addition if you have long COVID. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, good. Got about a dozen or so more questions here, maybe a few more. So the right now the score, by the way, is tied 18 to 18 for those of you who've been, been tracking. It's incredibly close.
That's impressive.
And now we're going to give extra points for helping me get through more of these questions. So you're going to get more points for hitting it a little bit quicker. It's a new rule change. It's going to be tough on Bob because he's a doctor. He likes to talk.
That's not going to work for me.
Okay. Sally Noel's a small.
I'll talk faster. See, how's that?
He just lost a point just for interrupting there. Okay. 18 to 17. Okay. Sally Noel. Bob knows I love him. He can have a point back anytime he wants. Just anytime you want, you can get that point back. I'm holding in reserve.
Now.
Okay. Sally Noel's a small business owner. She has a really interesting question. She's been asking for proof of vaccination for people who come in-house. She teaches yoga at a yoga studio. But she has a question about whether or not she should also be willing to accept people who have natural immunity from prior Omicron infection equally. She knows a lot of local people who haven't received the shots and were infected. And so that's part one question. And then I think she also has some other questions around how testing might fare after that. She says she hates excluding people. But of course, safety is number one. But I think there's this broader justification question of people with natural immunity. Okay, tough question to answer in a short time, but this is your challenge. We'll start with you, Bob.
No. Oh, you mean you?
Okay.
That was a long question, Andy. So I should have a little bit more time for the answer. Is your infection the equivalent of three shots? No. It gives you some protection. We don't know exactly how much. A lot of it depends on how severe the infection was and when you had it. And because of that lack of predictability, if you're going to check people's vaccination status, it's safer to be sure they got vaccinated. If you did have an infection, you should also get vaccinated. So one of the rationales for checking is to try to encourage people to get vaccinated. Even someone who had an infection should get vaccinated.
And where would you put testing in that? If someone was previously infected and showed a positive, I'd be showed a negative test. Would that change your answer?
I guess I'm trying. Let me try to understand the question.
Yeah, so somebody comes in
previously infected, right?
Previously infected, not vaccinated. They don't have a card, at least, but they can show up. They can show a negative test that they just took.
I don't think the fact of their prior infection is all that relevant. I think the essence of the question for some of the prior infection or with vaccination is a negative test a reliable measure that you are not infectious at that moment? And the answer is, if you did a rapid test within a few hours of coming into the space, it markedly lowers the probability that you were infected, but does not bring it down to zero. And we've seen that with Omicron.
I think this question would make an excellent SAT question with a logical reasoning, a little bit of a story problem. Okay, Caitlin, do you have an answer?
Yeah, I would actually accept an antigen test within the last, 2 hours before the yoga class if they weren't vaccinated. I think the more interesting, or I guess I'll stop there so I get a point.
Oh, man. You just.
Oh, I didn't realize we were playing hardball
discipline
here. This is different.
She got 2 points.
All right. Throw down the gauntlet.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network.
As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Melissa Wolf, how do you stay safe in a work environment where there's no mask requirement and no limit on the amount of people in a conference room? My work has been remote for almost 2 years, and now they're ready to go back to the way things were pre-pandemic. I'm concerned that my N95 mask will not keep me safe enough around the unmasked. What about eating lunch? Okay, Melissa Wolf's question. Okay, what do you think, Caitlin?
Yeah, the N95 is going to work great to protect yourself. It'll also help protect those around her, period.
What would you do for lunch?
I would, what I do at my own work and be a loner and eat in my office.
Okay.
But that's what I would do.
Interesting. Bob, note the tight answer, Bob.
Yes. For lunch, I think I'd have a ham and Swiss sandwich. In terms of the actual question, I think it all depends on the prevalence. So we may find ourselves a month from now with case rates that are low enough that it's perfectly fine to and safe to be inside with colleagues not wearing masks. Much, much safer if everybody's had three shots. So there's an argument there for vaccine requirements, which will make an indoor maskless gathering much safer than it would be otherwise. But if the case rates get down really low, and we can't count on this forever, but I think we probably will be in this situation at least next month, then we may be in a situation where taking the masks off and acting in an indoor space like it's 2019 is a reasonable thing to do.
Okay, good. Well, you actually are both doing so well that I'm gonna throw another proposed rule of the game to make it that much harder. From now on, you can no longer say it depends on the prevalence. There'll be a 5-point loss if you say depends on the prevalence. Okay.
That's hard.
If we say it depends on the number of cases or something, can we just use a different word?
Sure, you could try that.
Okay, thanks.
Christy Vaca asked, my booster is 5 months old. Will there be another booster for Omicron and when? What do we know about this, Caitlin?
So we know that clinical trials started with the Omicron vaccine. I am not convinced at all that we need an Omicron-specific variant booster. Once we have available those vaccines, it'll be past Omicron. I think the much more important conversation and scientific debate we need is how do we predict when we need that next booster and what that booster formula is. And that is something I don't have an answer to.
Okay. Fair enough. Bob?
Yeah, we may have a little bit of data to answer that question just in the last day on Twitter.
So up to date, Bob, on Twitter.
I know. It's unfortunately how I spend much of my life.
Point grubbing. Yeah. Go ahead.
So Israel, which is testing the fourth shot, the second booster in people over age 60, reported last week that they weren't seeing much of a benefit. They were seeing a benefit in antibodies, but not a benefit in terms of preventing cases or preventing severe cases. On Sunday, the Ministry of Health announced that they were seeing a benefit. That's the only data that we have. It hasn't been published anywhere, but the benefit that they cited was a twofold reduction in symptomatic cases and a threefold reduction in severe cases. If that turns out to be true, and it's not ready for prime time yet, we have to wait to see the data, but if that turns out to be true, then it's a reasonable thing to be thinking about a fourth shot. The challenge is going to be, I'm losing points up the yin-yang here because this is actually complicated, but I'll give it a try and you can cut
it. It's useful.
The challenge is going to be something we call in medicine number needed to treat, meaning if you've had three shots, the chances of a severe outcome may be so low. The chances of dying are infinitesimal. The chances of needing to go to the hospital are very low, that even a threefold reduction may not be clinically that meaningful. Mm. So if my chance of going to the hospital is 1 in 1,000, is it worth me getting another booster to lower that to 1 in 3,000? The boosters are perfectly safe. The answer may be yes, but that's very different than if the chance was 1 in 10 and I've lowered it to 1 in 30. That's the issue.
I don't know what you think, Caitlin. I thought that was a pretty useful use of time. What do you think?
I think so. Yeah. No points docked.
No points docked. I completely agree.
but no plus points. Just no points docked.
Let's not ask for too much.
All right.
Okay. Kim from California. She has so many questions, and the big one is about kids and how to keep kids safe in the next few years.
We have 2 kids, 6 and 3, and they've been in virtual school. They've missed indoor activities for 2 years. We've tried to shield them from what's going on. We went to an outdoor play date at the end of December, and afterwards, my vaccinated 6-year-old tested positive for Omicron. We didn't step foot inside. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, we want to be part of the world. We want to send them to school, and we just want to know, how do we move forward, and what's the new name of the game as far as letting kids live their life, but also keeping them safe? Thank you so much. Bye.
Both of you have kids, I believe. And one of you has a well-chronicled case of COVID among your kids, although your kid a little bit older, Bob. And Caitlin, yours are undoubtedly younger.
Two under two and a half.
So maybe we'll start with you, Caitlin.
That's a really tough question. You know, what I'm holding out for as a parent is their vaccine. We're hearing mumbles that a vaccine data should be coming out in February. I'm kind of not holding my breath until summer, though. And so what I'm doing is keeping them a little bubble around them as much as possible. That meant finding a daycare that does masks and make sure everyone's vaccinated. They're going to have to go to childcare, but we can make it as safe as possible. That means not going to the trampoline park, but going outdoors to the park, you know, the regular park all the time. So, you know, the name of the game for me, at least, is waiting for their vaccine and keeping them as safe as possible until that gets to that point or we reach an endemic state. And it continues to be an impossible landscape for us parents to navigate, especially those with us, you know, under 5.
Andy, I want to point out the skill there. The skill there is when she says, until we reach an endemic state, that means a low prevalence, but she's managed to avoid the point loss by saying low prevalence. Very, very, very impressive.
I think so. Very artful. Yeah. Is it reasonable, Caitlin? I think there are parents out there who say, you know what? My kids are 2 and 5. Putting a mask on them is ridiculous. The chances of them being sick, in other words, they have a very opposite attitude. Is that also reasonable, or would you say that that's a problematic perspective?
It is. No, I don't think it's problematic. It is a reasonable perspective. I think that, you know, some people have a numerator perspective and some people have a denominator perspective. But it is reasonable. There is questions. You know, my 2.5-year-old doesn't wear a mask well at all. So that's not going to really be helping anyone, but we can help in other ways. I think the other important point, again, goes back to, yeah, their individual level risk is low if they're healthy, but they are very good vectors for this disease and this virus, and they are part of our community and can reach unvaccinated and unprotected pockets. Yeah.
I thought it was strange that you named your daughter Vector, but whatever. Okay, Bob.
I think if it was a boy, it would have been Victor. And I'm first of all, I'm glad I don't have little kids now. This has just been brutal and all the complex decision making. You know, you can look at the, as you pose the question, Andy, I think, the risk to an individual kid, even if they get COVID, is exceedingly low. We know that there is this lingering uncertainty about long COVID. And in this case, I don't really mean the long COVID as in you feel fatigued a month or two from now. It's what is the impact of an infection on vital organs years later. We don't know the answer to that. It can't be very high, but it may not be zero. And if I was a parent of a young kid, I would also be trying to avoid infection to the degree feasible. And then that the question is, how feasible is that? And what is the cost? We've clearly learned that that virtual school carries a very, very large mental health cost on the kids.
And learning costs.
And learning costs, too. So it's almost an impossible question. And it's gotten so politicized that it's very difficult to have kind of a rational conversation about it.
Elizabeth asks a very specific question that makes a good follow-up. She happens to have a 7-year-old who's in first grade and is vaccinated, and a 4-year-old in preschool who obviously isn't yet. Her question is actually really, I think, a great one. And I've been asked this by school boards in different parts of the country. It says, she says, for each of them, she wants to know when we can start to discuss benchmarks for demasking in school settings. And what should those benchmarks be? If you were advising a school board, what would you say is the right moment to change their, if they've been masking, to say that they no longer need to mask? Is it the same prevalence question as before, 10 per 100,000?
I think it's low transmission. I think we're also going to get to a point where everyone's kind of had an option to go get the vaccine too. And we're going to get to a point where they've had that opportunity to be protected or not. And so, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think, yeah, I don't think the case numbers differ in terms of everybody's sort of willingness to take their masks off and congregate indoors. I think the kids are the same as adults. The kids, in some ways, the cost of masking is higher. Their risk of a bad outcome is lower. And so you might argue that the threshold can be even a little bit higher than it is for adult demasking, but probably similar order of magnitude. The cases have to be lower than they are now. And the issue that Caitlin raised is really a fundamental issue. At some point, it is rational to say anyone who is unvaccinated, and obviously the kids didn't make the choice themselves, their parents made it for them, but anyone who is unvaccinated, it has not been for lack of the ability to, the availability of vaccines, and the risk is largely to those people. The people who are fully vaccinated are really extraordinarily safe because of the magic of the vaccines.
Okay, questions that have an exclamation mark in them carry 5 points. And we have one from Cassandra Whitman. And these are really the how the hell does this make any sense type of question. So the 5 points. Sacramento County Public Health in California is allowing vaccinated children to attend school, even if family members have tested positive. No negative tests required. As long as they don't have symptoms, they must attend. How does this make any sense as a policy to slow the spread? Question mark, explanation mark. Caitlin.
I mean, technically, that's right, though. I mean, according to the CDC, if you're fully vaccinated, it sounds like that those kids are, and they were exposed, they don't need to isolate. So I actually agree.
But does it pass your logic test that if they've got people at home, they've not tested, they've been vaccinated, and we know it can spread within families?
Does it pass my logic test?
I've seen you disagree with the CDC. You do it very politely.
You do it very appropriately. No, everyone should be testing. We have antigen tests. They tell you if you're infectious or not. Take an antigen test and then go back to school.
So your answer is their policy does not make any sense. You're telling the capital of the largest state in the country.
You're going to give me in so much
their
trouble.
Their policy
Andy.
Doesn't make any sense. Okay, avoiding the controversy is a huge opportunity for Bob. Huge opportunity for Bob because Caitlin is avoiding the controversy. Bob, what say you?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think I agree with Caitlin that the more sensible policy is with close family exposures, the kid does an antigen test before that day in school to be sure that they're safe. It's all very probabilistic. The household attack rate with Omicron is about 30%. So it's not a done deal that you're, you know, that mom is infected, the kid is automatically infected. It's maybe a 1 in 3 chance the kid will become infected. That seems to me to be high enough that allowing the kid to go into school without the additional safety of a 15-minute test, it seems like it would be safer overall to just add an antigen test on top of that, as opposed to willy-nilly just they're fine to attend as long as they're asymptomatic.
Both of you seem to be in the pocket of Sacramento because you're unwilling to say what will get you 5 points, which is very simply say, this makes no sense. You're almost saying it. Are you saying it, Bob, or not quite?
Not quite.
Okay. Neither of you get the 5 points. Okay. Minhui Wang asks, what are your thoughts on the Harvard University and Columbia University isolation policies? I'll explain what they are. Currently, COVID-positive students are to isolate in their dormitories with non-infected roommates. With non-infected roommates for 5 days. Right, exactly. While breathing on each other in a small space. In fact, it's required that they breathe on each other. Supposed to be. Non-infected roommates can go about business as usual without daily testing. Infected students can go out to pick up meals and use communal bathroom facilities. Does this isolation policy make sense? If so, is this the direction we're headed as a country? This is another 5-point question. By the way, I should tell you that right now Zach is at school and has COVID and is in an isolation dorm. But
oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, that's okay. So Minhui Wang asks another. Oh, Caitlin grabs a 5.
Oh, she just came right in there without. Wait a second. On Jeopardy, if you buzz in before the question is over, you cannot answer the question.
Oh, no.
I thought that was an early buzzer.
Bob didn't hear a buzzer. Do you want to buzz? Yeah. Quick, Caitlin, press the buzzer.
Buzzer.
Okay.
No, I don't think it makes sense. I mean, in that case, why not? Why aren't we using tests?
But this is Harvard and Columbia. Aren't they smart people?
They are.
Yeah, I've taken a look at the Harvard and Columbia endowments. They can afford a hotel room nearby for the kids to isolate for a few days. Yeah. I mean, to throw these kids, again, the household attack rate is not 100%, but it's significant. And for a roommate to be exposed to the air filled with virus of an infected roommate and not to have an option of going some other place while the person is isolating, that just seems like it's asking for trouble. And these institutions have enough resources they could pull this one off if they wanted to.
So wait,
that's why I don't think they should call Harvard the Harvard of the East.
So the roommate that's not symptomatic can still go to class and stuff? Yeah, no.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't agree with that.
No. Good. I like how from you are that. Someone who has a question about people who are immunocompromised.
My question is, will older people, high-risk people with comorbidities, the immunocompromised, will we ever get to leave our houses, or do we get to spend the rest of our lives inside as hermits and only scurry out with a mask for 1 or 2 places? It's mighty damn discouraging right now. And now that Omicron BA2 is here, it's not looking good. I'd really like to hear what they have to think. Thank you.
Bob, let's start with you.
Yes, I think they will. First of all, you have to have tremendous empathy for people in this situation who are seeing everybody around them vaccinated and going back to life of some form closer to normal, and they can't. So what makes a difference here? I think therapeutics will make a significant difference. There's already a monoclonal antibody cocktail named Evusheld that a single infusion of that seems to offer some protection for a number of months. So it's worth exploring that. The Pfizer antiviral pill Paxlovid lowers the risk of a severe outcome by 90% in people who take it. And for now, the supply is quite limited, but we are giving it to immunosuppressed people. It doesn't work through your immune system. And so it should work fine in immunosuppressed people. And it's important to recognize that immunosuppressed people, their risk of a very bad outcome is not that much higher by virtue of their immunosuppression. Their immunosuppression makes it far more likely they will get COVID. So because their immunity is not going to fight the virus in the same way. So the combination of the monoclonal antibody and or the Paxlovid, I think is going to put them in a situation where it is substantially safer than it is now for them to go out and about. They probably have to be a little bit careful, but I don't think they're going to have to be hiding under the table as they've had to do for the last couple of years.
Caitlin, all you have to do is say agree or disagree.
Agree.
All right. All the points go to Caitlin. Okay. No.
It's brutal.
Great. No, I will. Brutal. No. Bob, you did a lot of the work, but Caitlin, I think she brought it home. Okay.
She brought it home.
Okay. Couple more questions, immunocompromised, and then I think we're at the end of our questions. People are having a really difficult time getting answers from physicians, their own physicians here, in what seem to be very complex situations, and it's hard to go through all of them. But Mort Cormack, I'm going to maybe put a few of these together. He talks about how he has his wife has lupus, so he's supposed to get another booster within 6 weeks. Trying to find out for the rheumatologist what level of risk to assume during Omicron and how to navigate it. Ali Martel asks, she has a question for those of us who are diabetic and are considered obese. Will her risk factors continue to be high, even being vaccinated and boosted? And what can people with these kinds of health conditions do to reenter life a bit and stay safe? And because she often hears messages that say, if you're vaccinated and boosted, do blank. And she doesn't know if she should be listening to those. Someone else's, Joseph Block, has an immunocompromised adult son who's had a J&J and a half dose of Moderna and wants to know if that's enough with Omicron. And Janice Cooper, his husband's taking immunosuppressants after a stem cell transplant for AML. And she's 9 weeks out after open heart surgery. God bless you both. They're both vaccinated and boosted, but in the world of COVID, they still feel that it's safest if they act as though they weren't boosted and that they stay away from crowds and are masked, etc. They wonder what their best strategy is. They're in their mid-70s, and they want to know if they're being too scared or too cautious. I think so to sum up this question, which we can answer kind of all at once, really difficult situations for people who are feeling very isolated. I don't think any of them are asking too much. I don't think any of them are trying to kiss caution to the wind, but all of them are trying to figure out how to get bits of their life back in some of these situations. And so I realize that you can't address everybody's specific needs, Bob, in this amalgam of questions, but I'm wondering if you have overall advice for people in this type of situation.
Yeah. First of all, yeah, I think we have to have a lot of empathy for people in these situations trying to navigate this and do the risk calculations. It's extraordinarily difficult. I guess as I heard all of those questions, I parsed them into two big buckets. And one is the person just at elevated risk by virtue of age or obesity or diabetes. And the answer is that the person who is a 75-year-old with risk factors who has had three shots has a lower risk of death than a healthy 30-year-old who is unvaccinated. The shots now, the recent data from the CDC says you are 100 times safer in terms of the risk of death if you've gotten three shots compared to an unvaccinated person. So I think the 75-year-old obese person with diabetes who's gotten three shots, first of all, better get three shots, and second of all, should go back to living life as if they have essentially normal risk. They do have an elevated risk over someone younger or who doesn't have comorbidities, but the risk has been, you've done everything you can to lower the risk. And I don't think there's any way to live your life. And this is going to be, you know, once we get out of the surge, this is a version of life going forward. And so I think you accept a very, very tiny risk and go and try and live life as normally as possible. For the immunocompromised people, you gave three or four different situations. It's really important to look at how immunocompromised you are. So just having lupus and let's say being on a low dose of corticosteroids doesn't make you all that immunocompromised. You probably did fine with your three shots. The person who's gotten a stem cell transplant and is on massive immunosuppressives, that's the person who's, as I said before, you're going to look to the therapies, look to the possibility of taking the monoclonals as prophylactic and the possibility of having access to the Pfizer drug if you do get infected. Because I think the bottom line is hunkering down for the rest of your life is not a tenable solution.
So I have to give you 5 points for that answer because you actually managed to hit everybody's situation, and you managed to provide somewhat of a solution and not just an outlook, but a solution for everybody. So you just earned yourself back into the running.
Thank you, thank you.
You retied the game with Caitlin. Caitlin, did you have anything you wanted to add to that before I go to the final bonus question?
No, I don't think so. I think it's basically what Bob said is that we have the tools now to make our lives very safe through boosters, through antigen testing, through ventilation, through masks. And so we need to leverage those so we can get out back into the public and continue to protect those around us, including immunocompromised.
Okay. Final question. And it was our final question in our last Safe or Unsafe. And it's a different version of the same question. And the question is, how many more Safe or Unsafe episodes will we need to do? Now, I will tell you that the last time we played this game, Farzad Bashashari in November, before Omicron, said zero. We've just done our last one. We will no longer need to do these anymore. We're going to be at a steady state.
Yeah.
So the answer you have to choose from is obviously zero. You could say 1 to 2. You could say 3 to 4. You could say 5+. So this is the final question. And Bob, since you just caught up, and since you've got the most familiarity with the show from anybody, so you understand what makes a good episode, you have a little bit of advantage. We'll start with you. How many more Safe or Unsafe episodes will there need to be?
Well, again, a lot of this depends on how risk averse you are. Farzad said zero, and he got exiled from the show. So it makes me not want to say zero. I will say zero, though. I will be gutsy and say we will still have mini surges going forward, but that Omicron will be the last game-changing variant, and the increasing availability of therapeutics will make life substantially safer. I recognize that's optimistic, and I recognize that can easily be proven wrong, but that is the bet I'm willing to make at this point.
Love the guts. Love the guts. Love it. Caitlin.
I was going to say 3 to 4 until Bob said zero. So I'm going to say 1 to 2. No, I agree with Bob. We're going to have more waves. And I think we're going to have more tools to figure out how to have a safe environment and make our lives safer. And I think it's worth coming on the air when those more tools come, or when the next wave comes, to discuss it. And then we'll kind of be on our own.
Well, I hope if we do have more episodes on this topic that you guys will come back, because you are both fantastic. We're gonna let the listeners vote.
Great.
Team Caitlin, Team Bob. You guys can get your social media forces out, your Substack, your papers, your office hours, all your tools out to try to sway the victors, the voters, because I'm finding it very hard to choose. I think you both are amazing. You're both amazing contributors to people's understanding of this pandemic. Thank you for playing Safe or Unsafe.
I was just waiting for the double jeopardy question. It never came. So
in the form of a question.
Thanks for having us, Andy.
You got it, Bob. Thank you. What do you think? Team Bob? Maybe. Team Caitlin? Promising. I hope that you have a choice, but I think they both did a good job answering your questions. I like the fact that they come from slightly different perspectives, but man, they're both super smart. Wow. Our episode on Wednesday is about what kind of protection Omicron infection has offered us and what that will mean for what comes next in the pandemic. Bill Hanage, Harvard School of Public Health, is our guest. Warning, he is English. Warning, he is very charming. So bring your defenses to that English charm if you're the kind of person that gets taken in by it. I, unfortunately, am a sucker for an English accent and literary references. He's a really interesting guy. He's a great guy. But an important topic is he's willing to look ahead and say what's going to happen here in the U.S. And he's writing about what's going to happen here in the U.S. based upon the fact that we have now most people in this country are either vaccinated or have a prior infection. So he's got some points of view on that. I think it will be a great episode. Then the following week, we have more great episodes to come. Thank you for tuning in. We'll talk on Wednesday. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly on your podcast apps. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McCohen produce our show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev and Veronica Rodriguez. Jessica Cordova-Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax are the executive producers of this show. We love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, and you can find me at Ace Slavitt on Twitter or at Andy Slavitt on Instagram. If you do like what you heard today, please tell your friends, and please stay safe, share some joy. We will definitely get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us on Archetypes, a dynamic podcast hosted by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, as she digs into the labels that try to hold women back. In each intimate and candid conversation, Meghan is joined by guests like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, Paris Hilton, Issa Rae, and Trevor Noah as they delve into the roots of countless common descriptors of women, like diva, crazy, dumb blonde, and the B word, and redefine and reclaim each identity along the way. The complete season of Archetypes is out now wherever you get your podcasts.